The following program is an MLWRadio.com production.
Matt Boone!
Media Productions. You remembered them fondly, and then they were gone. And now you want to know who, what, where, when, why.
We having fun, yeah.
Why It Ended with Robbie E. and Matt Coon.
Hey, what's going on, guys? And welcome to another week. We're back. It's Why It Ended off of last week's episode with Justin Credible. Matt, what is up, dog?
Not too much, dog, but let me ask you this, man. We got a little bit of feedback from the Justin Credible show last week, didn't we?
I'd say we got a lot of feedback. I'd say we definitely got more than a little bit. But you know what? Everyone loved the interview, and everyone is really pulling for Justin to hope that he gets into the place where he deep inside wants to be.
And we try our best to have a happy ending, and sometimes the happy ending's got to wait a little bit, and hopefully Justin pulls it through. And I thought it was a great show, and today I think we have another great show. We have one of my all-time favorite wrestlers, Mr. D'Lo Brown. How excited are you about D'Lo?
Well, you know, I will say when I first got to TNA, he was an agent there for my first few years there, and he definitely gave me a hard time for a few years. You know, there was some outside batting cages that I changed in, and some private locker rooms, like maybe janitor rooms that I had to change in by myself, or some missing elbow pads. So I'm definitely going to be asking about that today.
And also, make sure to follow us on Twitter at WhyItEdit. And hopefully by the time this show airs, our Pro Wrestling Tees store will be up. If it's not up by the time it airs, it's going to be up soon at prowrestlingtees.com/WhyItEdit. And also, we have a bonus show ready to go. All they got to do is what, Robbie?
500 subscribers on YouTube. Our show is Why It Ended with Robbie E., and we're going to give you guys that bonus show. Plus, remember, Instagram, at Why It Ended. And guys, after you listen to the show, make sure you leave us a review, give us 5 stars, and subscribe to the show. Tell your friends. Share it with everybody. Tell your mom. Tell your daughter. Just keep on plugging.
Now, we're getting a lot of feedback from a lot of people on the inside of the wrestling business. Now, let me ask you this, Robbie. Why do you think a big, huge star would text you that they love the show but not say it publicly? Do you think they're afraid to say that they like hearing these kind of sometimes gritty and dirty stories?
I tell you what, it's been a few surprising texts that I got of people that say they love the show. And I think who doesn't love a good story? I mean, we're all wrestling fans, whether we're wrestlers or non-wrestlers. We all love the business. And I think it's refreshing just to hear some people's stories. I mean, every story we've had is good. Who wouldn't want to listen to it? In fact, it's crazy. My wife, not a big wrestling fan, but her and actually a few of her friends who aren't wrestling fans either have been listening to the show, and they're like hooked. And it's not about the wrestling. It's just the fact that it's a really good concept and a good story they're getting each week, you know?
So we'd like to thank everybody who's given us shout-outs, including, of course, my friend Conrad, who's put us over every podcast he can. But coming up after this on our podcast, Why It Ended, one of the greatest wrestlers of the Attitude Era, D'Lo Brown. Did you know that Why It Ended plays to thousands of people every week? Now, these are wrestling fans, and they're in those ages that you want, the ages that buy stuff. And you can advertise on Why It Ended. Just contact me, Matt Coon. Do not contact Robbie. Contact me, Matt Coon, Matt, at mattcoon.com or on Twitter at Matt Coon Music, and find out how you can advertise your product, podcast, or any service you offer on Why It Ended. And please make sure to go to iTunes. Why don't you do it right now? Subscribe, review, give us a 5-star review. We'd love to keep bringing the show to you for free, but if you want to advertise, give me a holler, Matt Coon, at matt@mattcoon.com. That's matt@mattkoon.com. And joining us today, you better recognize, today we have D'Lo Brown. D'Lo, how you doing today, man?
I'm good, fellas. What you guys up to? And, you know, thank you for having me on the podcast. I appreciate it. I've heard good things about it. In spite of Robbie E. being on here, I hear it's pretty successful. So
I was just going to say, you heard something good and it had to do with my name. I didn't think that was possible, bro.
No, no, no. You happen to be on it. You're by default on it. So the podcast is good.
Let me just say, when I text you and ask you to do this, I was expecting like a big LOL back. But when you said yes, I did put two and two together and I figured out that you're only doing it because you feel bad for all the picking on me that you did for the years we were together in TNA. Am I right?
Absolutely right, because I all those times making you like dress in your own separate locker room away from everybody else, I have to pay it forward and give it back to you now because, yeah, I did ride you pretty hard in TNA. So, yes, the only reason I'm doing it now.
All right. Well, so the end of the show, we find out why it ended. But for the beginning, we want to know why it began. So how did you originally fall in love with pro wrestling?
Dude, like everybody else, I was just 9-10-year-old kid just watching TV and I remember flicking through the channels and there was wrestling at first. And I tell this all the time that, you know, it was WWF that was on. I think it was like Doink the Clown or somebody up there. And I was like, eh. And then I remember clicking the channel and then down the line, down the channel was the NWA. And there was Dusty Rhodes bleeding like a stuck pig. And I was like, Grandma, I found real wrestling. And she laughed at me and I was hooked ever since. And you know, I saw Dusty bleeding. The next week, it was like the Rock and Roll Express versus, you know, the Russians for the NWA World Tag Team titles. And it's like, oh, I'm home.
And where was this? Where did you grow up at?
I grew up in New Jersey. So we were lucky enough that we were, you know, I was sandwiched right between Philadelphia and New York. So between those two markets, I actually got WWF, NWA, World Class, Mid-South. We used to have like the power block, like it was like 5 hours of wrestling on a Saturday. If you were in the right part of the country, you could go from who needed Saturday morning cartoons? I had wrestling.
Exactly. Well, you fell in love with wrestling and you trained at the Monster Factory. And of course, we know that's a great place to go. A lot of pros came from there, but you found yourself in SMW with the Gangstas. And how did you come to SMW and what was your relationship like with Jim Cornette?
Okay, so I got to rewind back to in the Monster Factory. Balls Mahoney, rest in peace, at the time had gone down to do a angle with Chris Candido, also rest in peace. And he was doing a gimmick called Boo Bradley. So he went down and did the first run to get hired. So he came back to New Jersey to pack his clothes up and get his bags ready to move back down to Tennessee. Well, what the world doesn't know is Balls didn't have a driver's license. So,
gee, day, go figure. I wouldn't expect
go
that.
Go figure.
Shocking.
So one day at the wrestling school, he comes in. He goes, hey, guys, I need to get down to Knoxville. Anyone willing to drive me down there, and I'll try to get you a dark match. So it was me and a guy named Ace Darling. We drove him down there.
Oh my God! Wait a minute. I don't mean to stop you. You're close with Ace Darling.
Yes, I know Ace Darling very well. He was there tonight. Yeah, I love Ace Darling.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still close with him now. He actually just texted me the other day that he listened to last week's episode and he loved it. Because I mean, I only live 20 minutes from him. I've known him for years.
Well, I hope he loves the fact that I'm putting him over in this story because he's a good guy.
He'll be listening.
So Ace Darling and I drive down there. Jim Cornette gives us 8 minutes. He pretty much. Hell, got hired. I got hired then, came back down 2 weeks later, and I was in Pikeville, Kentucky for the Brew Glass Brawl, and I wrestled as AC Connor in the opening match, and then Jimmy goes, yep, I like you, kid, and he goes, you're going to be with the Gangsters in the main event, and I was D'Lo Brown in the main event.
Wow.
That's how I got my start.
Were you like, holy shit, was that like surreal happening all so quick?
First of all, it was surreal the fact that I'm sitting there looking at Jim Cornette. I'm in a locker room with the Rock and Roll Express. There's Tracy Smothers, this dirty white boy. There's Brian Lee. And I'm like, what am I doing here?
How did this happen?
2 weeks ago, I'm tooling around the Monster Factory learning how to chop. And now I'm here with all these guys I grew up watching. So,
how experienced were you even at this time? How long had you been wrestling?
Okay, full disclosure. At that point, I was a backyarder. And I just officially did one or two shows with the Monster Factory.
Oh my God.
Bro, this is a crazy story. I don't tell it too much. I had done one or two shows at the Monster Factory. I had my first professional match May 7th, 1994. I had done some TV work, a couple of job matches with Vince, and by June I was in Smoky Mountain.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's then, crazy. And I told Cornette, I said, Corny, I'm green. He goes, from this point forward, you tell everybody, if anybody asks, you can wrestle in 2 years. And when you get 2 years, tell everybody 5 years.
So you were placed with the Gangstas right away. And the Gangstas had a lot of really edgy, racially based angles and personality. What was it like working with New Jack? And what was that whole experience being part of that super hot and very controversial Gangstas gimmick?
Well, I will tell you that New Jack is one of the coolest people I've been around. And at first, I didn't even understand how strong a personality he was till I heard him go out there and cut promos. And I was like, oh my God, they're going to shoot us. People are going to come to the arena with knives and guns and they're going to kill us. And it was so cool to actually be around, you know, obviously, you know, growing up, you're watching guys like Jim Cornette getting real heat because they wanted to be a heel and people actually wanting to, you know, people jumped out of the stands at Jim Cornette. So it was kind of cool to be in that same thing where we embraced being heels and it didn't matter what New Jack said because he was going to make people mad. And that's what you wanted because then people paid to see you lose. People paid to come see you get beat. And we embraced being the heels. And man, after the shock of being put into the Gangsters wore off, the love affair I had with being in that group really started to flourish. And it was like, man, this is so freaking awesome. To be, you know, we were a hot act. We were the main event. We were the top guys. And it was great to be part of that.
Do you feel in a quick amount of time, like, because you were main eventing and with them, did you, like, learn wrestling, like, a lot in a little amount of time?
Well, one, we're wrestling four or five nights a week. Two, I'm in the ring with guys who – I'm in the ring with Ricky and Robert.
Yeah.
I'm in the ring with Tracy Smothers. I'm in the ring with, you know, Dirty White Boy. And then I'm getting a promo lesson from New Jack and from Jimmy every night. If you don't get better under those circumstances, that's a you problem.
Yeah, so you had no choice but to become great. Yeah.
I had no choice but to get better overnight.
So was it easy for you to be so mean because you're such a nice guy? Like, was it hard to become a gangster, you know?
Here was a cool thing about wrestling. You get to be somebody you're not.
You do?
Not you. No, you're stuck in what you are. You're physical. That's you. For me, I'm, you know, for those who know me, I'm a video game playing nerd. You know, I'm just a laid back, quiet guy. But it's nice to go out there and be something you're not and allow yourself to get into a character that you're normally not in everyday life. And so for me to jump in that, it was the guy I always wanted to be. So it was kind of cool to just jump into that character and embrace it and allow me to learn the business from the standpoint of, yes, I could technically wrestle, but I needed to know that character development, and that allowed me to grow that way.
So at some point, the Gangstas were signed or left SMW, and you got a contract from WWE. How did it come about that WWE became aware of you? I know they had a good relationship with Smoky Mountain, but why did they sign you? Who did they talk to? And what did that do to your dream of being a big-time wrestler?
I left Smoky Mountain in 95, went to Puerto Rico, ran around Detroit, Michigan area, ran around Ohio, and then went to Puerto Rico. So it was about a year after I left Smoky Mountain that I got signed by Vince. And it was when the Nation was formed in late 96. If you remember, they had a bunch of guys who were wearing bow ties, and they had Clarence the lawyer, and they had PG-13, the rappers.
It was like a Nation of Islam with hip hop mixed in.
Well, for those who don't know, all the guys in suits were Clarence's fraternity brothers. So none of them were actually wrestlers. So these guys were out there getting heat, and there was never any way to pay it back. You know, nobody could ever get their hands on them because they weren't trained. They didn't.
Got it.
They weren't any of the boys, you know? So then they started the process of looking for someone who could be in that group, who could take the bump, or could, you know, who could, they could get payback on. They face payback on. So Jim Ross and Jim Cornette promoted me for that, and you know, they put me out there, and you know, I remember flying in for Shotgun Saturday Night, the first Shotgun Saturday Night, and that's the famous Ahmed Johnson bump on the top of the car, and the rest is, you know, to the races.
So now, like, was it originally your dream to make it to the WWF at the time? Like, so now are you happy? Your dream's fulfilled. You're there. Like, was that it for you?
Yeah, I for me, I was like, hey, you know what? I'm here. Look, first of all, I never had the greatest body in the world. I don't have the greatest look in the world. I just want, you know, I wanted to get in this desk to have fun because I love wrestling. But things happen and doors open, and next thing you know, I find myself here. I am in New York City, and it's Shotgun Saturday Night, and I'm looking at Vince McMahon. There's that same aura I had when I was standing smoking in my locker room. Here's Vince, and there's Shawn Michaels walking by me, and there's Bret the Hitman Hart sitting 4 feet away from me in Cater, and I'm like, how did I get here?
Yeah.
So yeah, it was like, my God, I've arrived. If I don't do anything else, at least I've done this, and you know, I've done more than, you know, 90% of the guys who ever put on boots. And I was like, man, that's so cool. So happy. And then, you know, I was bow tie guy. I was nameless bow tie guy.
Right.
Hey, that works. But did any guy being just nameless bow tie guy and like knowing that you were still kind of new in wrestling, did any guys give you a hard time or anything in the locker room?
No, you know what? Love them to death. Bulldog and Owen are the consummate rivers. So I'll tell you, I forget where you're at. I forget what – I only got ribbed once. I forget where we were at, what building we were at. But – so I go out there and I'm – you know, people don't know that on the house shows I was wrestling and doing stuff like that. So I go out and wrestle, and I come back, and there's Davey and there's Owen. They're both snickering. When both of them were huddled together and they're giggling, you knew something was up for somebody. Yeah. So I walk in. I go to take my gear off, and I look. My bag is gone. What the hell? Where's my bat? And they're just snickering. They're just like, you know, huddling in the corner, waiting for me to figure out what's going on. So I'm looking around. I'm like, maybe I went to the wrong chair or something. You know, and so I can't find my bag. And I'm looking around. I'm going, I don't know what. So then Davey walks out of the locker room. And all you hear is, oh, my God, look at this. And I walk out. And you know the chains that are used to raise up the big rolling metal doors?
Oh yeah.
Okay, so they've hooked my bag to that. They've closed the door, so my bag is now 40 feet in the air, and they padlocked the chain together, so I can't lower it down. So my bag suspended 40 feet in the air, locked to this chain. And
so you gotta find a ladder.
I can't get it off because my bag is padlocked to it.
Oh shit!
It's locked, and that was the only time I was ever ribbed.
Wow, that's not bad, huh?
Oh, I'll take it.
So as the guy in the bow tie who looked good in the suit, who could actually work, what were the plans for you when you were brought in? Were you told what your future would be? Or
none was. No, there was probably no plans for me. It was just be the guy who needs to take the heat when necessary. And then, you know, we'll figure it out as it goes.
The Nation of Domination was originally a kind of a multi-ethnic group, and then it got split off. It became an all-black group. And it was you and, of course, the Godfather and a young Rocky Maivia and, of course, Ron Simmons. What was it like working with such a badass and such a great mentor like Ron Simmons?
For anybody who knows, Ron Simmons, till this day, is like the father I never had. Like, if I make a major decision in my life, I call Ron first for advice, even right now. And so the coolest thing about Ron was... And I'll tell you a Baltimore story that will be kind of cool. You guys all remember, was it 1993, Baltimore, Maryland, Ron Simmons beats Big Van Vader for the world title.
Right.
Yep.
Becomes the first black world heavyweight champion. So 1997, we're doing a show in Baltimore. We go down to the ring, hold our fist up, we go to commercial break, and I start looking around. Ron goes, what you doing? I go, hold on. And I'm looking. What are you doing? I'm like, Ron, right there. What? I was like, right there is where I was sitting when you won the world title. And he looked at me, and we're 10 seconds from going back on TV. Here comes the music. So now we do the promo, come to the back. As we come to the back, Ron grabs my shoulder. I'm like, oh, what did I do wrong? Ron spins around and goes, "Don't you ever do that to me again." I was like, what? And he hugs me. And he goes, "Love you, boy." Because he knew how much that meant to me to be there with him with that him. Night. And then 4 years later, I'm standing in the ring next to him, looking at the spot where I was. Ron was my mentor, my confidant. He was anything I needed to be. He was there.
That's awesome, man. What about like the when you were with The Rock then? Did you get along with him? Did you know he was going to have the success? Was he always such a talented dude? Like, what was your take on him?
Rocky and I have had – people don't know. We roomed together for over a year. So he and I, you know, I was living in Miami. We flew in the same plane up. We roomed together. We drove in the same car. He is as cool as the other side of the pillow, and I tell people that, and he's still cool to this damn day. For anyone who says they looked at Rocky in 1997 and thought he was going to become the star he was, they're lying to you. Yeah. Okay?
It was rough, right?
It was rough in the beginning, but what you did see was a work ethic that not many people had. Rocky would be in the car and practicing promos or you know, he'd be in the mirror, facials, people's eyebrow. He every time he was out there, he had this will to be better. And I'd never been around that. Like, I had been around guys who wanted to be good, and guys who wanted to be the best there, but I had never seen anything like that, where it was like nothing was going to stop him from being great. And then you got to watch the evolution. I had the front row seat. I got to watch the evolution of Rocky grow within the Nation and get his confidence. And like I said, he would practice different promo styles and different ways of standing. And then that's when the character, the attitude came out, and then it was just strap a rocket to his ass and light it up because he was headed to the moon.
Is it surreal, though, still thinking of, like, I mean, he's not just a star. He's the star. Like, is it still crazy thinking, like, how close you were with this dude and he's the number one guy in the world?
It is crazy knowing that he and I would room together and drive a, you know, a mid-size rental car because it was cheaper. Splitting gas money, splitting hotel rooms so we keep our expenses down to, you know, 20 years later, this brother owns Hollywood and probably going to run for president in 2020. It's amazing. And like I said, if anyone ever saw that rise, they're out of their mind. Maybe Rocky saw it in his dreams. No one else did. Yeah. But I'm glad he.
Were you there with him in conversations where maybe he said where he doubted himself or maybe this wasn't for him or that he lamented that first experience, or was he just always so determined to do that?
There was never like a moment of doubt. It was more of, I need to find my sea legs and be in this heel, because he had just come off the die Rocky die chance and the run as the babyface that did not work. And I'm thinking on some level that had to hurt him. That might have been what fueled him to be successful so much going forward.
So at some point it becomes D'Lo Brown the wrestler, and of course the entire package. We've done a lot of research on, you know, the fact that Jim Ross gave you the chest pad, you know, and mm-hmm. that you do the frog splash the way you do because of Art Barr, and you also do the head shake and that patented leg drop. As a character, as it developed, who is D'Lo Brown?
The character of D'Lo Brown is just a young, cocky kid who was, lack of a better term, he was overly confident because deep down he was so scared. If that makes any sense. Just a wannabe street thug who was trying to find his way in wrestling. And that's what the character's always been. And it's just an amalgamation of who I was when I played football and who I was in real life. And I just brought together and blew it up 1,000 times. And that's who D'Lo Brown was, for lack of a better term.
And we talked a little bit about this off air, because I just think it's so funny, is that you're this ass-kicking Nation of Domination, Nation of Islam kind of throwback, but once in a while they'd throw in the fact that you were a certified CPA. How do you think that kind of contributed or detracted from your character on screen?
I always thought, like, and I said before, I was like, it's really weird you get this, you know, 6'2", 300-pound black man kicking this guy in the corner, and, you know, JR goes, he's killing him in the corner, former main black bear, CPA. You know, and it's like, it just didn't, I don't know if it always worked together, but I'm glad it, you know, JR would put it out there, because it let people know that I was an intelligent wrestler. So everything I was doing was calculated. It wasn't just, I'm relying on instinct. I'm actually, my character's thinking about what he's doing and he's breaking it down. And it added a level of intelligence to my character that not a lot of quote unquote wrestling characters have.
Now, don't make fun of me when I ask this. I think I know, but wait. I have a college degree, but a CPA dude is someone who does taxes, right?
Okay, next question.
Oh my God. Isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, Robbie, you sure you have a college degree?
I just want to, wait, it is, right? A CPA, taxes?
Yes. Did you get your degree from Pep Boys?
I just wanted to confirm. I just wanted to make sure.
What did you think a CPA did?
I don't know, bro. I mean, I know it's, I don't know if, is an accountant the same thing as a guy that does taxes?
Yes. You know, the letter CPA stands for Certified Public Accountant.
Okay, all right. All right. That's it. I knew. I just wanted to make sure.
Dude, bro, your character is a shoot, isn't it?
I just wanted to make sure.
Golly.
It's a shoot, D-Lo. Okay, it's a little off the rails, but we're definitely keeping all that in, Robbie. I think that was awesome. So D-Lo, at some point, they tried a little bit in The Nation what they did with the gangstas, and they went for kind of an edgy racial angle, but they pulled back on it real quick. What was that experience like, where maybe someone pitched you the idea of having DX maybe spray some spray paint and then decide, forget it, we can't do this?
It was weird because it was start and stop, but I just don't think that the wrestling, the national or international wrestling world was ready for that abrasive of an angle. I always say I think The Nation was, 5 years ahead of its time, because if you did that later on, it would have worked. I just think at the time, the business wasn't ready for that big, strong, racially charged angle. And maybe there was some pushback somewhere from corporate sponsors. I don't know. I'm just guessing. I have no clue. But yeah, it got pulled pretty quickly and we just moved on.
And now in 2018, with everything being PG, I mean, it probably pretty much definitely wouldn't work, right? Would you say?
No, I don't think it would work today at all. That's just, it's just the way the world is today, would not work at all.
Yeah, Twitter would blow up.
Yeah.
we would shut Twitter down.
Hey, so eventually you start being looked at as a single and start being looked at for title opportunities. You get your first European title, which is a title that's a lot of people associate with you. What was it like when you were told you were getting a title, and what was it like the day that you won it?
It was weird because I show up to, it was Raw, and I show up, and it's the funniest thing. Brooklyn Brawler comes and goes, "Hey, D-Lo, I'll get you on the list," and he did some promo shots with me. I'm like, "Okay," and he goes, "Can you go over to Triple H and get the European title because we need you with that promo shot?" I'm like, "What?"
Spoiler.
I'm like, no, I don't, no. And I look on the board and I'm wrestling Triple H for the European title. I'm like, no. I'm not, no. You go asking for the belt. I'm not asking for the belt because that's just, it's just presumptuous. Like, we can take him tomorrow if I get it. And it was very weird because I'd never looked at myself like I could be a champion for Vince. I looked at a guy, I could be a guy who was there and contribute, but I never thought that the company looked at me in that light. And I, one of the coolest things was I remember going back home, to the hotel, which I've done this another time. I remember going back to the hotel and putting the European belt down, looking in on the bed and going, "Holy hell, how did I get here?" And when people, you look back at that reaction that I had when I won the European title and I scream, "I'm the champion of Europe," and I'm jumping up and down. That was genuinely real emotion. That wasn't me portraying a character or a gimmick. That is, damn, I've arrived. That was real emotion out of me. And I remember Vince Russo telling me that's the night he goes, "You're going to be a star," because that's what I was looking for. And that's when they started the company, and Vince started doing more things with me.
And then after that, you won the IC title and you had both at the same time, right?
Yes, and that was the most surreal thing. I remember... Because I X-Pac and I had bounced the European title around a couple times, and then I had beaten Midian on a Sunday at a pay-per-view for the European title for like my third reign. And then the next night I'm wrestling Jeff Jarrett And he had just beaten Edge the night before. It was in Toronto. That's where it was. He had beaten Edge the night before in Toronto. And I see Jeff Jarrett, and I'm like, okay, we're going to double DQ or something like that. And they tell me I'm winning the Intercontinental title. And I was like, once again, there's that moment where it's like, what? And then, you know, you have the match, you win it. Once again, I'm sitting back in that hotel room, and there's both belts laying on the bed.
Holy shit.
And I'm looking around for, like, it's candid camera. Like,
this can't be real.
On me? Who's playing the rib on me? And I'm looking around, I'm like, my God. And then it was the next night, someone told me I was the first person to ever win both belts together. And that was just, I could have died right then.
So is that hands down the highest point of your career, would you say?
For WWE, yes, without a doubt. Without a doubt, that's the highest point of my career, yes.
Did you think you were going to go on maybe even to, like, brighter things? You know, maybe a world champ? Like, did you think it was going to keep going upward?
At that point, the sky was the limit. I thought anything was possible. At that point, I looked at myself as a guy the company trusted enough to put not one belt, but on two belt on. And in the case of the European title, put it on me four times. So at that point, I was like, man, there's some room upward here. Like, there's more floors above where I'm at right now. So that was my thought.
About how old were you when you had both titles?
Ooh, that's a good question. Lost at SummerSlam 99.
So you were younger than 30. You were 29?
Oh, yeah, I was 29 at the time. 29 at the time.
Wow, 29 years old, two titles. That's got to just be an awesome feeling.
Yeah, it was amazing. I remember driving. It was in Minneapolis where I lost the belt to Jeff, both belts to Jeff. And I remember getting in the car that night and driving to the next town thinking, man, things are about to get fun.
Of course, you had one of the most influential people in all of WWF in your corner, Vince Russo. How important was Vince Russo to your career there as you ascended in WWF?
Oh, tremendously. As much as Cornette was like a foundation of my career, Russo would pull me aside and help me with character and help me open up to who D'Lo became. And then, with really good writing, good storylines, he was giving me a platform to perform out there and do things that, you know, I could only have dreamt of. And that was, he was very influential. To this day, once again, he's one of those people that I can call and ask him a favor or ask him a question, and he'd be right there to answer it for me. So he was very influential on me.
Well, of course, in 1999, that was a super crucial year and pivotal year for you, just going through the research and knowing what everybody knows. And of course, if we interview D'Lo Brown, it's almost like we have to talk about draws. And how do you feel, where are you at this point in your life with having your career always associated with one moment in the ring that ended so tragically?
It's still to this day difficult to know that, you know, I was in the ring with someone who got hurt like that and set severely. And I've said this 1,000 times and Draz said on interviews too, like, there's no anger or hate between us. It was one of those things. We both have talked about it. We both looked at it, and it was nobody's fault. It's one of those damn stupid things that happened. It hit me hard. Like, I literally left. That was in Nassau, Long Island. And I remember flying home and I retired. I was done. I was done with the business. I'm done. I'm going back to New York and going back to work again. I was done. And then Jim Ross called me after a couple of days and just said, you know, talk to me. And I was like, I'm done. You can just, you know, tear up my contract. I'm out of here. I'm never going to wrestle again. I can't do it. And then I give Jim Ross credit. He goes, okay, I'll call you back in a couple of days. Let you think on this. And then I missed the next week's Raw. And then he called me and he sat and had a talk with me. He had like a talk that a coach would have with me, like a football coach. And he gave me the, you know, let's not end two careers on this. And you know, why don't you, instead of throwing your career away, start wrestling and having draws in your heart and your mind and your matches. And then I remember later on that weekend, the call back to Jim going, all right, I'm good. I'm good. I'll be at TV this week. And you know, we soldiered through it. But I mean, I don't, I can tell people, I know for a fact I wasn't, I was never the same wrestler afterwards. I wasn't the same risk taker. I changed the way I worked. I became more calculated and not taking so many high risks, or I stopped using the running power bomb. I've never used it again to this day. I won't even think about it. But yeah, it was a pivotal point in my career.
Do you still keep in contact with Draws at all?
We haven't talked in recent times, but literally if we picked up the phone like wrestlers, we could talk like we just saw each other yesterday and we talked for 4 hours.
Yeah.
So it's just one of those things that, you know, distance creates, you know, time apart, distance creates a lack of connectivity. But I guarantee right now, if I were to call his house right now, we would probably talk until a respective significant other said, if we don't get off the phone, they're going to divorce us.
There's, like you said, there was no heat between the two of you. And
never any heat.
But of course, even in something that was an accident, how angry were you at yourself, and have you forgiven yourself?
Oh, I was extremely angry at myself because someone got hurt on my watch. Whether it was my fault or not, I was in the ring. I was the guy in the ring that night, and it was on my watch. And, you know, I've forgiven myself for being there, but I'll never forget, and I'm always cautious of, you know, people think this is playtime, and it's quote-unquote, I'm doing air quotes, no one can see it, but quote-unquote fake fighting. And people don't realize that in every match, in every move, in every spot, you're putting your life in the hands of your opponent. And the goal is not only to have a good match, but for both you guys to come out of that match the same way you went in it. And I promised myself that would never, ever, ever happen again on my watch. And knock on wood, that has not happened again. And I pray it never happens to anybody, because it's just not across the bear.
You said you were never the same wrestler again, and that's totally understandable. The D'Lo Brown that had won those two titles, that was on top of the world, that lost him to Jeff Jarrett and was driving home and said, there's nothing that can stop me now. That D'Lo was gone when that accident happened. Is that accurate to say?
That's safe to say, yeah. Yeah. It took me a few years to recover from that, and I think that's what cost me my momentum with Vince. It took me a couple years to right myself, and that's when you could see the progressive downfall of the character through the next 2 or 3 years with Vince was.
Hey, so looking back on it, do you think that Jim Ross was right and that two careers did end that night?
No, not end, because once I left Vince and then I went down to TNA and then subsequently over to Japan, I think a different environment allowed me to open back up again. And that allowed me to change. And a lot of my, like, you asked me if the European, your kind of title was a highlight of my career. That's why I preface it by saying with WWF, because I put some really quality stuff down in Japan that no one here in America, this is long before you could stream New Japan and All Japan and all that stuff on your computer. And I've got some really good work that I'm extremely proud of that I left in Japan. And that's some of the highlights of my career. I mean, standing in the Tokyo Dome with 100,000 people is kind of cool.
What were you doing in Japan? Were you doing singles or tags?
Tags. A lot of it was with Bull Buchanan over there. And we both left WWE around the same time. And we're in a group called ROD, which means, it's Japanese English, means roughly obsessed and destroy. Don't try to figure it out.
I won't. Come on, bro. I don't even know what a CPA is, bro.
Right.
Hey, I got to say this. I can't. Vince Russo's calling me right now on the phone. Can you believe that? We were just talking about him. I swear to God, he's calling me right now.
His ears are burning. That's why.
I swear to God, he's calling me like he's listening.
It's better than last week when we were on the phone with Justin Credible, and he said, I know where the bodies are buried in Stamford, and he gets a call from Greenwich, Connecticut.
Yeah. Oh, jeez. His phone's tapped.
Hey, well, D'Lo, of course we had to talk about that. And of course, it's one of the most crucial moments in WWF history in a lot of ways, but something else happened that I think may have affected you at the same time, because around the same area, within a couple months of the Draws incident, Vince Russo ups and leaves. And how did that affect you when Vince Russo left WWF?
A lot, because he was like, you know, he was the creative drive behind behind my character. And I don't know if that vision was shared or with other people in creative, or I wasn't their cup of tea. And I know Vince was going to give me an opportunity to kind of right my ship. So he was kind of keeping me relevant. So yeah, I believe it was a huge thing when he left. It took the wind out of my sails big time.
Did you ever think of going with him?
I was in a contract, and then they signed me to a new one. Probably 2 months after he left, I got offered a new one.
But that was after rumors came that you were going to leave and that you wanted the opt out. And Vince Russo even stoked those rumors by doing a online chat. And how do you think that affected you in the eyes of management, that maybe it was perceived that you were a Vince Russo guy like Jeff Jarrett, and Jeff Jarrett just took off and took a bunch of money with them? Do you think that affected you and your push in WWF?
There's potential there. I've thought about that a few times. I don't know if they ever perceived me as a Vince Russo guy, but I could see that being that, because Russo was really the driving force behind, you know, my character. So I could see if that was perceived that way. But I signed a new deal pretty much within a few months after he left, so there was never a question. I couldn't leave. I was locked in. I could not leave. I had signed a new 5-year deal. I couldn't go anywhere. So
you still had a year on your contract when you re-signed. Would you have gone if you had the option?
I don't know. That's revisionist history. Looking back on it 15 years later, I think the answer might be different than what it was at the time. But at the time, I had no desire to leave. I was around Ron. I was very loyal to Vince and the brand. They're the ones that gave me the opportunity. And once again, I was just happy to be out there on TV, working under that logo. So it wasn't part of what I wanted to do at the time. Now, once again, 15 years later, and knowing how it ended, you know, a couple years later, it's kind of like, oh, maybe I should have gone.
Those runs, when you had the Intercontinental title and the European title at the same time, of course, draws, and then, of course, Vince Russo leaves. Those are the last titles you ever held in WWE, right?
Yeah. After that, I put on a turban. And then after that, I was racist. And then I was gone. So, that was the last. The last title, the fourth European title was the last title I held in WWE.
How did you feel about doing like the stuff with Chaz and like that tag team? Were you guys cool with that? Did you think it was going to work?
I loved being with Chaz. Loved it to the day. You know, because Chaz and I, we're both Monster Factor guys, so it's kind of cool. I did not like it when they put us with Tiger Ali Singh and I put on a turban. And that was kind of like, But, you know, you go out there and you do the best what you're given. You never say no, you just go do it the best you're given. But no, I did not enjoy putting on a turban and no, did not like it at all.
Did you think it was weird or there was a reason why, you know, you were on top with two titles and then moved down to this tag team?
I just thought it was, for me, it was a way of just recoping, you know, with me and getting myself straight. So it didn't bother me that per se that much. It bothered me when it started becoming more of a, you know, the character wasn't what it once was. When I sat back and looked at it from a distance, I was like, wow, SummerSlam 99, two titles, and now I'm wearing genie pants and a turban.
So they put you with Tiger Ali Singh as your manager. And I think I saw a quote where you said that was the low point in your career, and you've kind of mentioned that you hated it. Why was it such a terrible thing for you?
It was just not who I envisioned being as a wrestler. And, you know, we start off, like I said, when it was Chaz and I, and we were wearing, like, the training pants, and we were out there having great matches with, you know, the Dudleys and having great matches with, you know, Edge and Christian. That was cool. And then when it kind of morphed into what I perceive as, you know, kind of a less than authentic character when we put the turban on, then it kind of was like, I'm just not feeling this. Just not feeling this. But I'm going to try it. I'm going to do it because I'm a good soldier. I'm going to do it, but I just didn't feel it.
And then this led, was this the end, pretty much the end of that run in WWE?
Okay, so Chaz and I, we worked as Lowdown. And then most people don't know, there was a year where I went down, WWE was just starting to developmental territories. So they had one in Louisville, they had one in Cincinnati, they had one in Puerto Rico. So Chaz and I got reassigned to Puerto Rico for 4 or 5 months. And then I went to Cincinnati for about 3 or 4 months before coming back one last time to the singles. And I think that's, if I remember correctly, that's when I started doing the, I was tagging with Chris Nowinski for a minute. And then I was with Teddy Long, and then I was pretty much out of there.
What was the conversation like when you were told, hey, we know you held two titles, but you need to go down to developmental?
It was a difficult conversation to have.
Who was it who had the conversation with you?
Jim Ross at the time, because he was head of talent relations. It was a difficult conversation, but I was trusting in the process. So you just believe in the process, and you go down and do what you have to do. And I went down to Puerto Rico, then I went to Cincinnati, help train Cincinnati, and then try to make my way back up to the main roster.
What did they tell you needed to work on? Like, you know, what was it you were lacking that you could learn in developmental?
I think that was trying to give me time to get away and clear my head,
sure,
in my opinion.
Sure.
That's what I tell myself. And that's why I was probably really accepting of it without causing a stink. I think I needed time to clear my head as well. So it you know, you like I said, you're a good soldier and you do what you're assigned to do.
And then, so what was the reason that you actually ended up exiting WWE? Well, how did that come about?
Contract was not going to be renewed because creative did not have anything for me.
Got it.
I believe that was the verbiage.
Was it Jim Ross who talked to you when it was time for you not to get your contract renewed?
No, it was Johnny Ace and Vince.
And what did Vince tell you?
He just said, you know, I appreciate everything you've done for us and we'll work together again in the future. And that was kind of about it. And I said, I'm pretty sure we will too.
What was your relationship with Vince like over the years?
Always good. Always good. It was never had a problem with Vince. I could go up and joke with him anytime. To this day, I think I have a good relationship with him. So, you know, I believe I'm in good standing with the company as it is. So I don't. Like, I'm like Switzerland. I don't have a problem with anybody. I'm like middle of the road. I try not to get in an argument with anybody. I'm truly Switzerland.
Were you bummed out at this time, or did you feel like, you know, this is an opportunity to kind of start over?
But yeah, you're bummed out. I mean, you work so hard to get to a place. And then I remember it was in, I'll tell you the last match I had was with Booker T. We were in Staples Center in LA. And I remember doing the match. I remember getting on the red eye home. And the damnedest, I was bummed out. I mean, the whole flight, the whole 6 hours back to Miami, I'm like, man, this sucks. This really sucks. The damnedest thing happened, though, is I got close to Miami. The freaking sun rose, and it wasn't the end of the world.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, all right. Let me just simmer down, relax, and then start looking at my options, you know, and just try to set myself up to make moves so when I could actually go out there and do some more stuff, I was able to go out and do stuff.
And you went to TNA and had a memorable series and memorable matches with AJ Styles. What was that experience like going from, you know, where you were at the top of the world and then they said creative doesn't have anything for you, and then now you're in TNA having some of the best matches maybe you've ever had?
And it was gratifying because it was that's where I got my mojo back again, where it was kind of like, let's let it all go again. Let's show everybody what a missed opportunity was. And then you get to go in there with a guy like AJ Styles, who was good at the time, and he was just getting better. And he was this up-and-comer who was, you know, he's what he is today, the best worker on the planet. And you go out there and you're like, let's let it all hang out and hold nothing back, because this is on film and people are watching. Let's go put it out there.
I remember I was there for at least one of them live, because I would go as an extra sometimes and do like explosion matches in Nashville. And I remember I was there and they were great. Did you ever think, like, similar to The Rock, is it crazy thinking now how AJ is pretty much on the, not similar to The Rock in that, but did you think he would blow up the way he did, like to be the number one guy in wrestling?
I always knew AJ was eager to prove that he wasn't just a regional star. Like, AJ wanted to prove that his act would play anywhere, anytime, in any ring, in any arena. And once again, he's another guy who had that kind of desire and passion to get better. And AJ was always good. And then he wrapped the total package around it with the look and the promo and the ability to have a match with a broomstick. He put all that together. And I think he really honed that while being in Japan, in his time in New Japan. Because he left TNA as one guy, went to New Japan for a couple of years, and came back another. And now you have the guy he is today. And it was fun being there towards the beginning of his career and watching his career grow and evolve to seeing what he is now. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think New Japan gave him a little more ruggedness and edge, right?
Yes, and I think they knocked that little, you know, Georgia boy out of him and gave him this worldly star factor. And he really, I think, really, really honed his craft in New Japan. Because, like, when he came back, he was somebody completely different.
Matt, do you think you could toughen up if you went to Japan?
I'm bigger than everybody in Japan. I would be just as tough as I am today.
So after you finished up in Japan, how did you end up going back to WWE?
That was just creative. Johnny Ace gave me a buzz and said, hey, we'd like to look at you. And I remember it was Madison Square Garden where I did a dark match. It was like, hey, let's come here and let's see what you're. So if you've changed your game or not, and let's try to give you a look. And I remember walking out in Madison Square Garden. It was the coolest thing because, and it's amazing how you remember certain things. They didn't even play my music when I walked out. They played some generic, because it was a dark match. They played some generic music. When I walked out, the garden was quiet at first, and then I walked out and the place went crazy.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I was like, hell, they remember. And I got in the ring and there was a D-Lo's. Holy hell, they don't just remember, they're happy. And then went up there and had a great match with Connor of the Ascension, of all people. And I remember leaving New York and it was like, we'll be in touch. And then I think it was like 6 months later, I came back.
You weren't really given a shot, though, fully to come back. Or I think they said they didn't have anything for you again, right?
Yeah, it was a second verse, same as the first. It was I wrestled every house show there was between in the, you know, 9 months I was there. I think it was on TV like 5 times.
And at that point, did you know it was a wrap for you and WWF?
Yeah, at that point I was like, you're lucky to get one shot. I got two, and I was like, yeah. The second time didn't work. It's not, you're not going to get a third. So I was content to just move on with myself again. And I think I went back to Japan again. And then that's when I decided, I was like, okay, let me start looking at the next step in my career. And that's when I contacted TNA and we started talking about me doing some agent work for them.
So you probably came in, because I was there when Al first started.
You came in right after. You were quickly there. Yeah, because you kept blowing my phone up because you wanted to get dark matches. Oh, wait, I'm not supposed to tell about that.
Well, something tells me Robbie got plenty of dark matches.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what? I did. There was a while where that's all I did. I'll tell you that.
Look, let me take a break from talking about me, and I'll talk about Robbie for a second.
Oh, God. Well,
I'm going to put you over, kid. Just relax. I will give Robbie a ton of credit because he's just, if you look in the dictionary next to the word effort, there's Robbie E. Dedication and commitment, because he kept trying and trying and trying and knocking on doors and ringing phones and sending emails and knocking and doing everything you had to do. And he did it so much, people said, hell, give this kid a job so he leaves me alone. and then he goes out there and he, every time he was put in a situation to do something, and this is agent D'Lo talking, every time he was put out there in a situation to do something, he exceeded what you wanted him to do. And damn, I'm gonna hate this tomorrow.
Well, thank you, Robbie, bro. I already love it.
But Robbie's a very talented worker, and beyond the Jersey Shore exterior, there's a talented wrestler in there.
So thank you, man.
Enough said. No, you suck.
Yeah, hey, Matt, the record button's on, right, Matt?
You know, something just happened to the software. I'm sorry, Robbie. I don't think we got
Sweet.
That. It'll just be a moment between the three of us. So you did make a couple more wrestling appearances as part of Aces and Eights, and I think Aces and Eights is something that started with like a lot of heat. It was going to bring in some new young guys, but kind of like the NWO Black and White, it kind of morphed into like a lot of guys, and the angle got watered down. How did you think? How did you think the Aces and Eights could have worked out better for the company?
It had a lot of steam, I think it grew too big too fast, and just at one point it seemed like half the locker room was in Aces and Eights, and that's kind of
right,
kind of just watered down. And people don't know that I was never scheduled to be in Aces and Eights. When the gimmick was created, all the guys were wearing masks.
Right.
So they needed extra bodies to make sure certain things looked good, and that was my way of, as an agent, helping teach the next generation of guys how to do things. So that's when I started appearing under the hood and just being part of run-ins. And then it morphed from one thing to the next, and next thing I'm pulling the hood off and I'm the vice president. And that was not the plan going in. It just worked out that way.
So looking back on your career and the insane arc it took in 1999, why do you think D'Lo Brown did not get a bigger moment, a longer moment in the sun as one of the brightest stars in the biggest company in the world?
See, that's a hard question. I think I got a great moment, and I'm very appreciative and respectful for the time that I had. And I will put my career up against most guys. I mean, sure. I think I've done a lot, and look, even a shooting star is bright for a moment. And I was a shooting star. I mean, if you guys know me, I won't give it all to my email address, a shooting star. So I even know what I was. My moment, I appreciate it. And for as long as it was going to last, remember, I was a fat kid from New Jersey who should never be given a shot in the first place. So my moment was good, damn good. And I'm very proud of everything I've laid down in the ring. And then I'm proud of everything I've done backstage afterwards. So if I look at the totality of my career, I got no regrets, and I'm very pleased and happy with it.
And you definitely shouldn't, because you're definitely one of the bright spots of the Attitude Era, and somebody that when we put it on Twitter, everybody remembered and everybody was excited about.
In 2018, what is D'Lo up to? I know you're training at a school out in Vegas, right?
Yeah, I do some training out here at the Snake Pit, along with Sim Bodie and Jake Snake Roberts. We take guys who are either have no experience, or we can polish guys who've been wrestling for 10 years. So it's more like a finishing school, and just my way of trying to give back to the business that gave so much to me. I've got a lot of knowledge in my head, and I need to get it out of here and give it to somebody else now. It's their turn to carry it. So that's pretty much what I do out here in Vegas. And I do appearance. I'll do signings or a show from time to time. But, you know, for the most part, I'm just happy, just, you know, content training and watching other people and living vicariously through the students now. Love doing seminars now.
What about wrestling matches? Will you still wrestle a match?
If you're willing to bump for me, kid, I'm out there with you.
Hey, we never wrestled each other, bro.
No, we didn't. But, bro, I my back hurts and I don't want to carry you anymore.
You did for a lot of live events.
Can you please frog splash Robbie, please?
Oh, God.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us, D'Lo. You can go to booking at him. You can go to bookdlobrown@gmail.com or to follow him on Twitter. He's @DLobrown75. D'Lo, thank you so much for being here. I'm a huge fan. I don't think I've been more excited to talk to anybody than to talk to you. I hope you enjoyed doing the show.
I had a great time, guys. Thank you for having me on, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, man.
Robbie, I hate you.
I hate you too. I love you.
I love you,
dog. Hey, thanks, D'Lo. Appreciate it.
Take it easy, man. Thanks, bro.
Thank you. So, Robbie, that was a little bit different. An interview with all-around nice guy and super smart guy, and a guy who's kind of at peace with his life, Mr. D'Lo Brown. What'd you think?
Well, I think it's great now that I know that I could ask him to do my taxes, because I wasn't 100% on that one. But yeah, I would say definitely different than all of our other interviews. Would you say? Well, actually, you know, similar. To, he might be as nice as Glacier.
Yeah, he's kind of in that Mark Capani state of life right now.
Yeah, I mean, he's living in Vegas. He's got his wrestling school thing going on. He's being a smart dude. He's got kids going on in the background. So it seems that he's happy where he's at in his life, which is a good thing. It's good that we're ending the show today, especially after last week, on a positive note, would you say?
Absolutely. I think that a lot of people, everybody loved the Just Incredible show, but a lot of people kind of left maybe with an uneasy feeling. And I think that this D'Lo Brown show did not give you an uneasy feeling, especially if you did not know what CPA meant.
Yeah, and I think that's the cool thing about our show and the whole wide-ended concept, because for some people it ended and it's really a dark place, but for some other people it's a really positive, sunny place, like he said. So every week in our interviews are cool for different reasons, and that's what's making the show so fun.
And of course, the show is fun. We're still trying to get our bonus show out to you guys. We have a great bonus show ready for you to go. Get us up to 500 subscriptions on YouTube, and it's yours. Also, make sure, I believe by the time the show comes out, ProWrestlingTees/WyattEnded for your favorite Wyatt Ended t-shirts. Hey, Robbie, I'm thinking of maybe a CPA ? Shirt for Wyatt Ended for D'Lo's episode.
Yeah, I figured you were going to say that. But I mean, dude, we got to get these shirts coming. I mean, we're a few weeks behind because we have so many projects that we're working on, and we got to make sure these shirts are happening soon, because fans are hitting me up.
Exactly. And of course, you can go to Twitter at Wyatt Ended, Instagram Wyatt Ended. And Robbie, what do you got going on coming up this weekend?
Well, this weekend, let's see, Thursday, I will be in Ringgold, Georgia for a huge show, which has got like Hall and Nash on it. And guess who else is on it? My buddy Buff Bagwell.
Oh, fuck yes. What date is that? That's Thursday the what? Thursday, April?
That is Thursday, April 26th. And then I fly April 27th to Boston, where I return to Chaotic Wrestling, where I haven't been in many, many years. I started my career there. And then from there, April 28th, I actually have a double shot. I have an afternoon show. I have a morning seminar I'm teaching, then an afternoon show in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. And then I am driving back home to Jersey, where I have a show in South Brunswick, New Jersey for FPWL. And it's a fundraiser for Puerto Rico. So it's a pretty action-packed weekend, 4 shows in 3 days.
And my schedule is pretty similar. From Thursday through Sunday, I'll be sitting in front of a computer.
Oh, well, that works.
Yeah, same. And, of course...
Hey, I'll be taking pictures with Buff Bagwell, bro.
That's great. Well, you know, taking pictures with Buff Bagwell is a slippery slope for a lot of people.
I'll tag you in it.
So if you want to find out all the stuff that Robbie's up to, including his Fight TV show and also his Muscle and Fitness feature every week, Dad Bod Destroyer, you go to robbies-e.com. And we are wide-ended. Hear us on iTunes. Please subscribe and give us a 5-star review. We want to keep this show coming to you. And we will see you next week on Why It Ended.
Yay, dude, is someone who does taxes, right?
Okay, next question.